Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In America today, the largest mental health service providers are often county jails. The South Dakota State Legislature has focused efforts to study access to mental health services in the state this summer. Committees are set to provide recommendations before the 2020 legislative session. The challenges in South Dakota are not unique. Dr. Kenneth Rosenberg wrote a book, a 2019 book called Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis, and it gives readers an inside look to the expansive social crisis that is mental health in America today. Dr. Rosenberg interviewed hundreds of people about serious mental illnesses for the book, which serves as an urgent wake-up call for rethinking how we care for individuals and families impacted by mental illness. And Dr. Rosenberg joins us now from New York City on the phone. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here.
So this book, by its nature, is a collaboration with so many families, so many patients, people who have been through so much. Talk a little bit about some of the challenges and the connections that you made in finding so many people who were willing to tell their very intimate stories. And then we'll talk about your own story and how it is part of this book as well.
Right. Well, the first thing I did is spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, which is the epicenter of the crisis. And I'm happy to add perhaps the epicenter of change right now. But for many years, it's been the epicenter of the crisis. The asylums, which were closed in the 60s, were done even more so in California. California was in the forefront of what was called deinstitutionalization, closing the asylums and creating other places which really never materialized. So as a consequence, people with serious mental illness had nowhere to go. And they ended up in the streets, they ended up in the jails. As you say, the largest mental institutions in this country are our jails. The three largest mental institutions are the three largest jails, Cook County, Rikers County, and Twin Towers in Los Angeles. So in Los Angeles, I met people in the streets. I actually spent a lot of time in the emergency rooms, and with people's kind consent and their doctor's consent, and in some cases their family's consent when possible, I would really spend time with them. In fact, for a couple of families, I spent years following them and to really understand and be able to convey what it means to have serious mental illness in America today. And what it means is that, you know, you're very likely at some point in your career as a patient to be restrained. You're very likely to be medicated against your will. You're very likely to end up in a jail. You're very likely to end up in the streets. And you're very likely to not want to take your medications for a couple of reasons. One is people with serious mental illness have something called anosognosia, which means they often don't know they're ill. Also, the medications have serious side effects and they're far from perfect. So even if you know you're ill, even if you want to take the medications, you don't like it a whole heck of a lot. The medications are really substandard in my view. So we talk about all those things in the book, and we also have a film coming out in PBS in April 2020 on Independent Lens, and we'll dig deeper into that in the book as well.
Let's talk about those medications, because it seems like in this day and age, we should know a whole lot more than what we know, and those medications should be better able to be genetically matched, for example, to somebody's individual needs. What's going on with the research, and how come we're not further along with dealing with serious mental illnesses?
Well, the first reason is that the brain is very complicated, the most complicated organ, and we don't really understand the mind and the brain all that well. The 1990s were the decade of the brain, and we made some advances, but nothing that's really translated into real advances in treating psychosis. We have made advances in treating depression and anxiety, and we have made advances in treating psychosis, but largely we are relying on the same compounds, if not the same exact pills, that were developed in the 1950s, even 1940s. Lithium, which is the gold standard for treating bipolar disorder, was developed accidentally, as most of the drugs, if not all the drugs, were. Lithium was developed accidentally in 1949, and that's a drug that, if someone has bipolar disorder, it's the gold standard to be used. There was a drug called clozapine, which is an advance of sorts, developed in the 1980s, but there hasn't been anything recent. So part of it is that the brain is really hard to understand. Another part of it is that people don't give a darn. You know, the mentally ill have been relegated to the back wards, and we have not been speaking up for them. And I would say we have not been speaking up for our family members and ourselves. Mm-hmm. So people with mental illness get really, you know, not the treatment they should get. If you have cancer, God forbid, or you have HIV, God forbid, you get a treatment that's a couple of years old. You get a protocol that's a couple of years old. If you have a serious mental illness, you're likely to get a treatment that's been around for decades, if not since the 1950s. And that's got to change. Pharmaceutical companies have all but withdrawn from the neuropsych business. There aren't any promising compounds that they can easily exploit. And the research has not been there. And research funding for people with serious mental illness is a fraction of what it is for cancer. So if you look at the NIH funding, for instance, and you look at cancer, let's say, you know, you'll see it really is much greater. Cardiovascular disease, cancer, these are diseases which don't affect as many people with serious mental illness, but get a lion's share of our funding. Now, that's great. We should be investigating cancer and HIV and cardiovascular disease, but we really should be developing mental illness, and we should be having protests and marches and ribbons and all those things that we do for other illnesses. And another reason why we don't is because of stigma. People are ashamed about having a mental illness, and they're even ashamed of their family members having mental illness. So we kind of cower in the corners, if you will, and, you know, hide in the shadows and don't talk about the problem. And, of course, something we can't talk about, something we can't face, we're not going to fix.
Let's go ahead and define for listeners, when we talk about serious mental illness, what does that cover? What are we speaking of?
So mental illnesses are very common. Mental illnesses affect 50% of the population, but serious mental illnesses affect a few percent of the population. We're usually not talking about substance abuse. Now, I'm an addiction psychiatrist, so I would say substance abuse, which affects 15 to 20% of people in their lifetime, is a serious illness. But when we talk about serious mental illness, we're talking about bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, suicidal depression, and maybe very disabling personality disorders. But it's, you know, all told, is about less than 5% of the population. Still, if you know, it affects 1 in 4, 1 in 5 families, because a serious mental illness like that affects everyone. And if you have a child with a serious mental illness, you have a sibling with a serious mental illness, you know, it's really going to shape the nature of your entire family structure.
All right, let's talk about that stigma. And it goes back to really a legacy of colonial times, a legacy of you know, religion. There's a lot happening here. Tell us a little bit about where some of this, you know, the sense of forced shame and stigma comes from.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not sure I could really answer it sufficiently, because I think that it's been around forever. I think it's kind of in the human psyche, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have something that is considered a physical illness, if you break a leg, especially if it happens on a football field, you're almost proud of it, right? And you certainly don't hide it. But if there's something wrong with your thinking, if you're, you know, quote, crazy, unquote, if you're not right in the head, if you know you're feeling scared, we consider that a great shame in our culture and in most cultures, for that matter. Now, our culture in American culture, I think we're particularly shaming in that way, and we put a high premium on will and, you know, picking ourselves up by our bootstraps, which is a good thing. I can't argue with that. But when it comes to people who have a serious psychiatric problem, and we blame them for that, that's terrible. So a classic example in my mind is that we used to blame the mothers of people with schizophrenia. Now, that is really insane, if you ask me. So in the 1950s, if you had a child with schizophrenia, there was a possibility, a strong possibility, that the mothers, of course they would pick on the mothers would get called schizophrenogenic, causing the schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we have continued that tradition, right? So it's in our psyches, it's from the very beginning of time, but we have really run with that. And fortunately now we're seeing that's absurd. People have physical illnesses. Why can't they have mental illnesses? You see an internist, you know, once a year or once every few years. Why can't you see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker and talk about your problems?
Right. Let's go back to the law enforcement, angle of this, which is so many law enforcement officers spend a pretty significant portion of their time dealing with mental health transports, dealing with mental health, the people who are in mental health crisis. This isn't something they asked for. It's not something that they were trained for. What is the way forward? You mentioned Los Angeles being the epicenter of change. Where are we seeing some ways where we're trying to figure out how to sort of decriminalize serious mental illness?
Great word, decriminalize, and decarcerate as well. Well, one of the things we're doing is we're training police officers, because whether we like it or not, when there's a mentally ill person, the police are the first responders. And so police get called. But in some cities, what we're doing is creating crisis intervention teams that go out, and especially in small communities where that is done. There's a wonderful model for this in Trieste, Italy, of all places. Mm-hmm. And in this small town, which is a World Health Organization exemplar for good treatment, they are out there in the community working, really hard. They have community mental health centers that are open 24/7. They have a couple hospital beds, but they're rarely used because they don't need them, and people are accepted in the community. It also helps when you have universal health care. I'm not arguing for socialized medicine or Medicare for all, but I am arguing that when someone has a serious mental illness, they really need, help. And they need early help. Early intervention saves lives, and they need preventive treatments. So, a system which is not just based on treating the sickest people or treating you when you're very sick in a hospital or a high-tech place, but a system that's based on reaching out to people and treating them where they're at is really very important. We also have very few hospital beds. We have literally 2-3% of the hospital beds per capita that we had in 1950 for people with serious psychiatric illness. That's got to change. And we need hospitals that are not a jail by another name, but are more inviting. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of social changes we need to make in our culture, starting with the people who deal on the streets with those folks with serious mental illness, the police, and needing to get trained and having specific counselors who know how to do that.
Now, you can't tell this story without telling your own family's story. What were some of the challenges of that? Because for your family, this was a secret for so long. And tell me a little bit about the personal journey that you went through with your sister and with sort of telling that story. I don't know if this was for the first time, but certainly in a very public way.
Well, it's almost for the first time. I mean, I rarely talked. I'm 63 now. I rarely talked about mentally ill sister until I was about 50. And even people I was close to, my wife, she knew about her by the time we were married, but it really took several years for me to be able to talk about it. So I rarely spoke about my sister. I shared that shame, and I shared that stigma, frankly. I went to become a psychiatrist, and I barely told a soul why I was there. And I was there because when I was 14, my sister, who I love so much, became seriously mentally ill. And it was then, at the age of 14, that I decided I'm going to become a psychiatrist and help people like my sister, help families like my family. Mm-hmm. But it was very, very hard to talk about. But in this project, this Bedlam project, this book and this film, I've asked, as you said, many, many people to tell their story. And I realized, heck, I think I need to tell my story too. It was also a framework for the book and the film, because in the book and the film, I talk about my own experiences, so you really understand why I am out there. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, but I'm really in this field, and part of my mission in life is really to help people like my sister. So I felt it was really incumbent upon me to talk about it. It wasn't easy, and frankly, it's still not easy.
Yeah.
It's she had a very, very difficult life. She jumped out of her bedroom window and plagued by hallucinations, nearly killed herself, and then died at the age of 55, which is unfortunately characteristic of people with serious mental illness because of their lack of medical care, and because of the medicines, maybe because of the problems that they encounter in life, they die 15 to 30 years sooner than the rest of the population.
Yeah.
So, what I say in the film, what I say in the book is you can't fix something you can't face. So I have to face that. And I would say that American society has to face it. I think that my tragedy is an American tragedy. My family's tragedy is very, very common. My family secret is a common secret. It's an American secret. And the purpose of writing the book, the purpose of making the PBS film on in April, is to have a conversation, because there's lots of things we could do. We touched upon them, national policy changes, new medications, so forth and so on. But we can't do anything until we are able, as a society, to have a conversation.
One of the most valuable, really essential parts of this book is the practical advice for persons with SMI and or serious mental illnesses and their families. It's an extensive part of the back of the book. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the importance for you to sort of assemble this guidebook, really, for, you know, what do you do if this is happening in your family?
Exactly. Well, I think that's very important, because in the film, we don't do that much of a prescriptive, situation. The film was shown at Sundance. It's a film which, really depicts life as it is for on the streets and the jails for people with serious mental illness. But I felt in the book I really had to provide some kind of direction, because who's going to read the book? People with serious mental illness or family members of those with serious mental illness. So I thought it was really incumbent on me to do this. So I really provide, some direction, what to do, when to call the police, what happens if you have to call the police, how do you collaborate with folks who have serious mental illness, how do you use the legal system if you need to, because as we said at the beginning of this, people with serious mental illness often have something called anosognosia, means you don't know you're sick. So how do you help someone who doesn't know that they need help and actually often fights against treatment? So in the book, we provide some basic discussion of something called assisted outpatient treatment. We talk about something called psychiatric advanced directives, in which you collaborate with a person who has serious mental illness during a time when they're well and say, hey, if you get sick again, what's it we should do and what's it we should not do? So you have kind of a plan that they're in on, because when the psychosis takes over your mind, the consequences are epic and you can't really make decisions for yourself. So it's important that you, in some way, get involved in those decisions. Mm. So that's kind of some of what's in the back of the book.
All right. The book is called Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. We've been speaking with Dr. Kenneth Rosenberg about that book. There will also be a PBS Independent Lens film in April. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. I'm sorry for the loss of your sister as well.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.